Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 14th of July. Our main stories: the World Health Organization warns that the coronavirus pandemic will get far worse unless governments do more to stop it. We have a special report on how Morocco is tackling its outbreak. And can llamas help in the fight against COVID-19? Also in the podcast:
any name referring to a culture by the color of their skin is just implicitly racist.
After years of campaigning by Native Americans, the Washington Redskins give in to pressure to change their name. It is a sobering thought. There will be no return to normality in the foreseeable future. That's the warning from the head of the World Health Organization amid concerns that some countries aren't doing enough to tackle the coronavirus pandemic. Speaking at the WHO's headquarters in Geneva, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said too many countries were headed in the wrong direction. And if they didn't start following basic healthcare precautions, the outbreak was only going to get worse.
The virus remains public enemy number one, but the actions of many governments and people do not reflect of this. The only aim of the virus is to find people to infect. Mixed messages from leaders are undermining the most critical ingredient of any response: trust.
I asked our Geneva correspondent Imogen Folks what countries are doing wrong.
Dr. Tedros divided countries up into a series of categories today. He talked about ones which acted very early and controlled the virus, and I think he's thinking about, for example, New Zealand. Then he suggested, you know, some countries in Europe acted relatively quickly, got it under control, and are now taking a very cautious step-by-step approach to easing restrictions and seeing how it goes. But then he talked about other ones where there is intense transmission. And of course, there are two countries in the world which are responsible for more than 50% of the cases. And these, it seems, are the United States and Brazil. So the epicenter of this pandemic remains in the Americas. Although he didn't name them, he said there are countries that are going in the wrong direction, and that unless we can do the basic hand washing, distancing, masks where it's appropriate in crowded settings, this is just going to get worse and worse and worse. And as you said there, he said we're not going to go back to the old normal for the foreseeable future. So I think he's trying to say, look, you've got to get used to it. All of you, governments and citizens, get used to this, get on with it and try and bring this thing under control. And he clearly thinks, he was very critical of what he called mixed messaging. He clearly thinks that there are some governments who are not really leading their countries through this crisis and hopefully eventually out of it.
And how do they see things going in the next few months? Because one of his colleagues said there was a suggestion that we won't see a return to blanket lockdowns.
Well, that was Dr. Mike Ryan. I mean, I think what he was trying to do was show understanding for countries where there is serious community transmission and even intense transmission, that they're not imposing blanket lockdowns. He was trying to show understanding that this is obviously very economically and socially damaging. But what he said was, you know, even in the countries with the intensest transmission, there are areas where the virus is not very much present. But what you need to look at, and it will take an awful lot of effort and data gathering, is local lockdowns. Try and stamp on it where it appears, where there's really intense transmission. So it's a kind of qualified, okay, no more blanket lockdowns. Nobody wants them. Nobody really thinks that we can afford them. But we are going to have to accept that some communities, some villages, towns, cities, we've seen Melbourne, we've seen Sydney, there may have to be local lockdowns to try and stamp out an emerging cluster of cases.
Imogen Folks. One country that has taken a fairly strict approach is Morocco. It only recently came out of a tightly controlled 3-month lockdown and now restrictions have been reintroduced in the northern port of Tangier after a new cluster of infections emerged. Road and rail transport in and out of the city has been suspended, and residents are being told to stay at home. Richard Hamilton, our former Morocco correspondent, has this report.
A police patrol warning people to stay indoors during the lockdown. It was implemented quickly and seems to have worked. Officially, Morocco has recorded fewer than 16,000 cases and just over 250 deaths. A study by the Moroccan Institute for Policy Analysis showed that most people were generally satisfied with the government's handling of the crisis. But the restrictions have been very tough. Miriam Adu is a documentary maker who lives in the city of Saleh.
One day I took my mom to the hospital and we have to stop to cross the bridge. We stop and the police check and told me what's the problem. I showed them the doctor paper and then there is checkpoint every 300 meters. So you cannot escape. You cannot get into the train station without work permission. You cannot go to the tram without work permission. And they will check out when you get in and when you get out all the time. If you don't have this paper, they will not arrest you, but they will oblige you to pay a fine.
Sahir Bisher works in a bank in Rabat. Sometimes he would have to turn down loan applications from people whose businesses were suffering. He says the government's swift and efficient intervention has come at a cost.
A lot of people had to go through a rough period the past 3 months, especially people who are, for example, very social. Between a day and another, they are asked to stay home and not leave the house. I understand like the financial shock, of course, and the psychological shock that the coronavirus had on a lot of people in Morocco. People were affected in their health, for example. A lot of people had family members fall sick. A lot of people lost their jobs. There was a person like who actually committed suicide because like he didn't receive the financial assistance in time. A lot of people have been battling depression, have their mental health actually deteriorated.
The Moroccan authorities closed airports, schools, mosques, cafes and shops. All of this was enforced by the army and the police. Lockdown also coincided with the holy month of Ramadan. Ali Mohammed, who lives in the central town of Beni Mellal, said after a month of fasting, it was particularly hard not being able to celebrate the festival of Eid.
So it was all the month we was sick in the home, you know, don't get out to do nothing, was fasting, we don't drink, we don't eat as we want. We were all waiting this day. During all the month, we were waiting this day to get out. It was forbidden to get out.
In Saleh, market traders are back selling their wares in the souks of the old Medina. After months of not being allowed out, Moroccans are enjoying their freedom. But what's happening in Tangier shows that they must still be on their guard.
Richard Hamilton reporting. As it becomes clear that the coronavirus will be around for some time to come, scientists are speeding up their search for treatments. Researchers in Britain are hoping that antibodies from llamas may hold the key to providing an immune therapy. Their work is published in the journal Nature Structural and Molecular Biology. Our science correspondent Victoria Gill has more.
Just like us humans, llamas have antibodies in their blood, and they work just like ours do. When our bodies detect an infection, we make new antibodies that are specifically shaped to lock onto that particular virus or bacteria. But while our shape-shifting antibodies are highly complicated structures, llamas have much smaller, relatively simple ones. And that simplicity has enabled these scientists to remold llama antibodies, engineering them so that they can attach to and kill the coronavirus. Professor James Naismith from the Rosalind Franklin Institute led this research, and he said his team are essentially reproducing in the laboratory what an immune system does in the body, cutting a new key to fit the coronavirus lock.
We've got a key that doesn't quite fit, but it sort of goes in the lock. It doesn't turn all the way around, but it starts to turn. So we take that key out and we polish the bits that we know are likely to change, and we then get increasingly the key gets better fit until it turns the lock.
The researchers say a particular benefit of their approach is that the llama-based antibodies can now be made relatively quickly and easily. So if, for example, the virus mutated suddenly, they could just cut a new key. The team hopes that a therapy based on this cocktail of engineered antibodies will enter clinical trials later this year.
Victoria Gill. Since the killing of George Floyd in May and the protests that followed, much of America has been questioning the legacy of its racist past. There's long been criticism of the name of the American football team, the Washington Redskins. Now, after almost 90 years, it's being dropped, along with its logo of a Native American. The rights activist Amanda Blackhorse welcomed the move.
This is definitely a monumental moment for Native people in our fight to eliminate racist mascots and names. I actually never thought this day would come.
Major sponsors, including FedEx, Nike and Pepsi, had threatened to withdraw funding over the name. Les Carpenter writes about the Redskins for the Washington Post. He told me why the change had taken so long.
The team's owner, Daniel Snyder, has absolutely refused to change the team's name. His thinking's always been he grew up in this area. He was a huge Redskins fan as a child. He thinks the name just is an institution and you couldn't possibly change it. And he would even seek out opinion as kind of pressure grew over the years to, you know, other Native American groups and things that would say, look, we're, you know, we agree with the name or we don't have a problem. He would find these people. And I think it just it really became a deal since the George Floyd killing, really. Just the pressure got too great. And I think the tipping point was FedEx. Founder of FedEx is actually a co-owner of the team and was a friend of his at one time and said, look, if you don't change the name, we're going to pull all of our sponsorships. They also have the naming rights to the stadium and all the signage as well.
So the name is going to be changed. We don't know what the new name will be yet, and it is quite a complicated process.
Yeah, they're trying to do what, you know, many franchises would maybe take 2 years to do. They're trying to do this literally in a couple weeks, and it's outrageously fast, and I think they've realized that, which is why today's announcement wasn't, hey, we've got a new name, hey, we have some big new splashy thing. It was, well, hey, we've been doing a review, and at the end of the review, we're going to change the name, but for right now, we're going to remain Redskins, and thanks, see you later.
Because they have to change the helmets, the uniform, even the address.
Yeah, the address of their team facility, they, you know, is the name of a street called, I think it's Redskins Park Way. They just finished putting their media guide together because training camp is opening soon. And the media guide is 500 pages just filled with the word Redskins. And that's just a couple things. There's going to be signs on buildings. There's going to be business cards, the website. So many things that are going to have to be changed. And you're also going to have to acquire the trademark rights and everything before you can probably do make these changes.
And might it lead to other teams changing their names?
I mean, the other ones that are the targets of people here in the U.S. are the baseball teams, the Cleveland Indians and the Atlanta Braves. The Super Bowl champions, Kansas City Chiefs, have a lot of Native American imagery in their logo. Their main logo is the arrowhead. I think that over time, yes, you will probably see more of these changes. They've happened really the last two or three decades in college sports, but now in professional sports, I think it'll be a little bit bigger deal.
Les Carpenter from the Washington Post. This is the Global News Podcast, and still to come.
I didn't know what to do to keep people back from the bar. We live in a rural area. Everybody knows what an electric fence is, so I put one in the bar. It'll catch on.
The pub in England, which has gone to extreme measures to enforce social distancing rules. The British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, has set out the UK's plans for a points-based immigration system when freedom of movement with the EU comes to an end. The new visa system is set to come into force on New Year's Day 2021. Ms. Patel told MPs about the planned overhaul.
We are ending free movement and we are introducing a points-based system. And today we have published more details of that system, which will enable us to attract the brightest and the best. A firmer and fairer system that will take back control of our borders, crack down on foreign criminals and unleash our country's true potential, building a brighter future for Britain and signalling to the world that we are open for business.
Our political correspondent Rob Watson told me more about the new system.
Well, in theory, I got to say, it's a pretty radical approach if they actually go ahead with it as stated. And it essentially has two elements, Holly. The first one is that it's universal. So instead of having the free movement from Europe, the idea is you have the same immigration policy towards the whole of the rest of the world. So as the government would like to put it, it's based on not where you come from, but what you've got to offer. And the second bit, and this is truly radical, is really, it seems to me, it's designed to absolutely cut down on low-skilled, low-paid immigration. And of course, that is potentially radical because the UK economy is very much service-based, cafes, restaurants, all that kind of thing, which is very hungry for cheap foreign labour.
Yeah, and a lot of sectors say this new system could leave them short of staff, particularly the health and care industry. What does the government say about that?
You're absolutely right. It's not just cafes and restaurants, but the UK's care homes are staffed in large part by foreign nationals. What the government appears to be saying is that, look, the solution is not to have these homes, which of course have been front and centre during the COVID-19 crisis, staffed by cheap foreign immigrants, as they would see it, but to just pay British people more. But of course, care home owners, not just care home owners, are rather sceptical about this, both about whether British people would really want to do that and about the ability to find the money to pay them, even if they did.
And this is all a reminder, as we've been noting over the past couple of weeks, that Brexit hasn't gone away and the government's been telling us to get ready.
It has. And you know, one journalist pointed out that the blitz of government advertising, rather expensive government advertising, rather reads like something that might have been put out by the Remain side during the 2016 campaign, ironically, because the government is warning that essentially, whether you're a person, a car part or a pet, life is going to get more difficult, more tricky in relations between the UK and the European Union. Travel will be more difficult. The trade will be more bureaucratic. So it's basically saying to people, businesses and pets, watch out. You're going to need to adjust.
Rob Watson. In Nigeria, violence between the mainly Muslim Fulani cattle herders and Christian farmers has been going on for several decades. But the conflict in the North Central region, also known as the Middle Belt, has escalated in recent years. It's been blamed on global warming, which has destroyed much of the roaming Fulani herders' usual grazing lands, forcing them to seek new pastures elsewhere. But many Christian villagers claim they are victims of a form of jihad that their government is doing little to stop. Mike Thompson has this report.
Villagers in north central Nigeria cover the bodies of local people killed in an attack by Fulani herdsmen earlier this year.
Around 11 p.m., Fulani came and attacked my village, shooting at the window. I stayed for a long time on the ground.
John Bullus, a Christian farmer, lives in Plateau State.
When the thing quiet for some time, I come outside. My parents and my other relations were killed. I lost 21 people that very day.
John says his village has been attacked 8 times, and on 3 occasions this year alone. Some in the region have come to see these assaults as much more than a battle for scarce resources.
The whole world seems to connive with this narrative of describing this as a farmer-herder clashes. There's nothing like that in these issues.
Archbishop Benjamin Kowashi.
These people are sleeping in their farms, and the attacks are with guns and with knives, and they are slaughtered. And you call that a clash? These farmers don't have guns. They don't have anything.
Archbishop Kwashi cares for 62 orphans at his home in Jos and a further 370 in an orphanage next door, many of their parents victims of the violence which claimed more than 1,000 lives last year. Much of this, he claims, is carried out by extremist groups of Muslim Fulani herders intent on forcing Christians off their land.
They want to destroy over Christian villages and take over Christian lands. This has been proven, and they have one objective, to wipe out the Christian people.
It's a deliberate narrative to create a bandwagon effect against the others.
Saleh Al-Hassan General Secretary of Métis à la Cattle Horée, a cattle breeders' association which represents many Fulani herders, insists the conflict is more about shortages of grazing land than religion, and is being provoked by Christian vigilante groups as well as bandits.
The herders are the first victims of this cycle of violence because they rustle their cows, they kill them, so they will be the last to be the aggressors. But if they don't defend those cattle, they have nothing.
And this fractious debate in a country home to almost equal numbers of Muslims and Christians is now gathering pace in the southeast of the country too, since growing numbers of Fulani herdsmen gathered in the forest there. Dr. Kingsley Udegunum lectures in peace and conflict studies at the University of Nigeria.
Even during the lockdown, as a result of the pandemic, there were mass movement of young people of northern origin into the south. They were seen in lorries, they were seen in long vehicles, and people are afraid that there is something being planned.
Presidential spokesman Geba Shehu insists that the violence has recently declined. Plus, he utterly rejects claims that Fulani herders are behind any kind of religious war.
Many of them have not even gone to school. They don't even practice Islam. They're just managing animals.
So you think there's no jihad in the making?
No, there's nothing like a jihad playing out.
That report from Mike Thompson. Next to a border clash in the Caucasus involving long-term foes Azerbaijan and Armenia. The two countries have been at odds for years over Nagorno-Karabakh, a breakaway territory seized by ethnic Armenian separatists some three decades ago. But the latest fighting, which left four soldiers dead, took place a long way from the disputed region. So what's going on? I've been speaking to our South Caucasus reporter, Reyhan Dimitri.
What we know so far is from the Armenian side, the Armenian military spokesperson, she reported on Sunday that there were attempts made by the Azeri armed forces to invade the Armenian territory. She said that they used a military vehicle, a jeep, basically an attempt to enter into an Armenian territory. And at the same time, we heard from Azerbaijan that reported that it was Armenia which launched an attack against an Azeri military outpost in that area, in the western region of Tovuz. And the Armenian side is known as Tavush. So we've seen so far drone footage, which was published by the Azeri Defense Ministry, and it shows what appears to be an Armenian military post being destroyed from air. We also saw some still images published by the Armenian side showing that jeep, which I mentioned, also being destroyed. And as very often with this conflict, both sides have accused each other for starting this.
And we've had outside powers backing their respective allies, Turkey supporting Azerbaijan, Russia supporting Armenia. Where does it go from here?
It's a very good question. Where do these peace talks go? Since political changes in Armenia in 2018, the Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan, he's been insisting on including the de facto authorities of Nagorno-Karabakh in peace negotiations. And these terms Azerbaijan always considered unacceptable. We've heard the reaction from Turkey. And as always, they stood by the Azeri strategic partners and they've criticized Armenia. We've also heard that Armenia appealed to the Russia-led military bloc. And in fact, they published a statement saying that there will be an urgent meeting to discuss this latest flare-up, but since then that announcement was deleted from their website.
Reyhan Dimitri. Some of the biggest names in American entertainment have been paying tribute to the Hollywood actress Kelly Preston, who's died at the age of 57. John Travolta said that his beautiful wife lost her two-year battle with breast cancer after she fought a courageous fight with the love and support of so many. Fellow actor Russell Crowe said he would remember her as a sparkly-eyed gem, while the singer Mariah Carey described Kelly Preston's death as a heartbreaking moment. Here's our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd.
Well, she was actually born in Hawaii, originally as Kelly Smith. Her natural father died when she was very young. Even as a teenager, she was going up for films roles, started to make films when she was barely into her 20s. She established herself really very quickly. In 1988, for instance, she was in Twins with Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger, which people will remember. Always glamorous on screen, but she was very effective as an actress, much in demand. Jerry Maguire, which was in 1996, was probably where most people internationally became aware of Kelly Preston. She's very good in what was director Cameron Crowe's probably most popular film, one of Tom Cruise's most interesting performances, well worth watching all these years later. Here's just a tiny bit of the scene where her character realises she's been dumped by Jerry Maguire.
It's all about you, isn't it?
You stop.
I have to finish my job. You and I are salespeople. We sell. Look, it's not love me. It's not trust my handshake. Okay. It's make the sale. Get it signed. There shouldn't be confusion about that.
Okay, just jump right into my nightmare. The water is warm.
What was our deal when we first got together? Brutal truth, remember?
Well, that was an iconic scene, wasn't it, when Kelly Preston really came
Great
into
fun.
The fore. But she was also well known for being one half of a Hollywood power couple with the actor John Travolta.
Oh, indeed. There was actually a short-lived first marriage, and after that, briefly, she was engaged at one point to Charlie Sheen. But in 1987, as you say, she met John Travolta, then, of course, a huge star around the world. They'd been married since 1991, a very long marriage by Hollywood standards. Maybe family life got in the way a little bit, as it can do. There were fewer really big films later, but she was always in demand on the big and also on the small screen.
And Vincent, just briefly, this isn't the first time that the family will have experienced tragedy.
Sadly not. Kelly Preston and John Travolta had three children, Jet, Ella and Benjamin. 11 years ago, Jet, the oldest, died whilst the family were on holiday in the Bahamas. That's referred to in one of the many online tributes today from Maria Shriver, formerly for many years, of course, married to Arnold Schwarzenegger. She wrote, "Shocked by this sad news, Kelly was such a bright, loving soul, a talented actress and a loving mom and wife. My heart breaks for her family who have already known such sadness and grief."
Vincent Dowd talking to my colleague Celia Hatton about Kelly Preston, who has died at the age of 57. St Just in the English county of Cornwall is said to be Britain's most westerly town. But in a move that some might say was more Wild West than West Country, the Star Inn pub there has installed an electric fence to enforce social distancing at the bar. Our correspondent John Kay has been finding out how the measure to control the spread of the coronavirus is going down.
That is £12.30, please.
On its website, the Star Inn is described as traditional, picturesque and full of Cornish charm. So customers turning up for a pint this summer might be shocked, but hopefully not, to discover warning signs and an electric fence running the length of the historic wooden bar.
Everybody would come in the door and come straight here to get served.
It was the idea of landlord Johnny McFadden, who's also a farmer.
I didn't know what to do to keep people back from the bar. We live in a rural area. Everybody knows what an electric fence is, so I put one in the bar. Okay. People are like sheep. Works for the sheep, works for the people. It'll catch on. More pubs will do it.
This morning, after reading about the electric fence in a local newspaper, the pub's insurance company phoned just to check it wasn't fully functioning. Away from his customers, Johnny does admit that it isn't actually switched on. But he claims the fear factor is having the desired effect. And the Star's regulars say the fence does make them think.
There's always that element of doubt, isn't there, whether it is on or not. So you're going to be a little wary just in case, because the battery on the floor as well, which makes it adds to it, doesn't it? Rather nice. It's a good joke done well.
There is a problem, though. The fence might have been designed to keep people away from the bar, but it's become such a talking point, it's now attracting extra visitors wanting selfies. Maybe the landlord should charge.
John Kay, reporting from Cornwall. And that is all from us for now. There'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.